Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. I want to say thanks for all the kind words offered this year from nice folks about Indiana Weekend. This is a good time to look back on some of our favorite shows. These are some of the ones that people mentioned when we're out and about. For instance, she's a history teacher and a former newspaper editorial writer. Andrea Neal has done a lot of things, but few projects that compare with the scope of this one. A 100-part series of newspaper columns on Indiana history. The series is called Indiana at 200 and is timed to lead up to the state's bicentennial in December 2016. She's covering the state's history chronologically, so of course she's had to reflect on the state's first inhabitants.
We didn't get the name Indiana just for no reason. This was the land of the Indians.
Of course, and that's the story that's the hardest to tell, because it was the land of the Indians long before LaSalle came, of course. And there are several tribal nations that had major populations here by the time the Europeans arrived. I'm thinking of the Miami, the Delaware, and the Potawatomi. But of course, Indiana's Indian heritage goes back long before that, to the time of the mounds builders and we don't know their stories, unfortunately. The only stories we know are those that archaeologists have been able to piece together by studying mounds and studying ruins and studying archaeological evidence. But we certainly do know that Indiana, what can genuinely be called the land of the Indians, both as a matter of sort of ancient history and as a matter of modern history, when it began with the arrival of the Europeans.
It must be really fun because you're a teacher. You teach history.
I do teach history.
And so does this help you connect with
students? Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's interesting. I teach U.S. history, but as a result of this column, I've been able to work in Indiana stories. I teach the American Revolution, and we've been able to talk a great deal about George Rogers Clark and the role of the frontier. I think it's important that we do consider some of these Native Americans as Hoosiers. Little Turtle, the Miami chief who ultimately decided to get along with the European American, and then Tecumseh, and that's one of my favorite stories. Of course, Tecumseh was originally from Ohio. I don't know that we can call him a Hoosier exactly, other than he and his brother moved their major headquarters of the Iroquois Confederacy to Indiana, and were hoping that from there they could launch kind of a successful resistance of the white occupation. And, William Henry Harrison was clever when he knew that Tecumseh was out of town, down in the southern United States, recruiting other tribes for his Confederacy, when they went up north to the area of Prophetstown, where Tecumseh and his brother had set up this headquarters. And when Tecumseh was not there, the American army were able to conquer the Prophet's headquarters. Now, that wasn't the end of the Iroquois Confederacy. It would be a couple years later, really during the War of 1812, when Tecumseh was killed at the Battle of the Thames, that dream kind of died. But I like to think of Tecumseh as a Hoosier. Oh, I have a good story about Tecumseh. It's apocryphal, so I'm not sure I should tell it on your show. But Tecumseh was from Chillicothe, Ohio. And that the story goes, he had a very, very good friendship with a white girl whose name was Rebecca Galloway. She would have been maybe 8 or 9 when he was a young man, and she allegedly taught him how to read and write in English, which he was an excellent speaker of English, an excellent writer of English. And so obviously someone had taught him. And then the story goes that when she got old enough, he asked for her hand in marriage, and she said, Tecumseh, I'll only marry you if you take on the ways of the white man. And he, of course, refused, and he said, but I will marry you if you would agree to take on the ways of the Native Americans. And she refused. But, and this is the true part of the story, some years later, descendants of both Tecumseh and the Galloway family got together and sort of smoked a peace pipe to recognize their family's kind of shared story. Apocryphal, though it may be, but I like that story because I can trace my own lineage to the Galloway family.
So in every place and everywhere, the folks like to think that, you know, there's something unique and special about their state. So is there an Indiana character, do you think?
I think there definitely is. And Lincoln's a good place to start. I think we see it with the work ethic, the integrity, the morality that he developed. And I think that this is something that comes out of being the frontier at the time of his childhood. You had to work harder to survive. There were more perils around you. For example, there were bears in Indiana that he had to worry about. There were Native Americans that people on the frontier had to worry about. The conflict went both ways, of course. And so I think that a lot of the hardscrabble nature of Hoosier comes from our frontier pioneer experience.
Does anybody know where the term Hoosier comes from?
Oh, there are so many stories about that. And I am doing a column on sort of all the various theories. The one about finding the ear and saying whose ear is the least credible.
That sounds like a Mike Royko.
I tell you, one of my favorites is actually about an African-American preacher by the name of Harry Hoosier. And he was sort of a fairly decently educated, circuit-riding African-American Methodist of way back. And there's even some indication that his name Hoosier, because he was of sort of this hardscrabble character, and that the state was named after him. Now, there's not a lot of evidence for that, but there's been an entire article written in the Journal of Indiana History about Harry Hoosier. Oh, I think it probably referred to sort of a backwoods type person who came from the Kentucky area and who moved to Indiana, and it was intended as an insult. But boy, I think of it as a label that we should be proud of now.
We're sometimes called we're linked with the idea that we've produced a number of vice presidents, Schuyler, Colfax, and...
Isn't that interesting that we're the land of vice presidents? Only one president, Benjamin Harrison, of course, although we can claim some of Abraham Lincoln and some of William Henry Harrison, but only one president, but as many, more vice presidents, I think, than any other state. Most recent, of course, being Dan Quayle.
Yeah.
The question is why? Is it because our location, our size, our population, our great political leaders just can't really vie for the presidency, but they're trusted, they have integrity, they come from a state of strong two-party system, so they know how to wage a political battle. All of those are possible theories.
Andrea Neal, a history teacher and former editorial page editor, is a syndicated columnist writing a popular column about Indiana history called Indiana at 200. You can find her column in newspapers around the state and on the website of the Indiana Policy Review, where she is an adjunct scholar. That is inpolicy.org.
And take me back to the hills of Indiana.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
Professional guitar players treasure their road-worn instruments, both for the way they look and the way they sound. And vintage guitars, say a 1962 Fender Stratocaster, have a different sound than today's instruments. So Kevin Hefferman, himself a former road musician, has found his niche. He sells vintage guitars out of his Noblesville shop, and he takes new guitars and relics them, which means that he turns them into instruments that have that well-worn feel, kind of like getting a pair of stonewashed jeans, maybe.
I've always been an old soul, I guess, you know. I mean, from the time that I was a little bitty kid, you know, Grandpa, can I have your old jacket? You know, that is so cool. It's got the panels on it. I like that. When I was like 12, who does that, you know? So I was always into just old stuff, aged. I hunted arrowheads. I grew up on a horse farm. We had old leather everywhere. It was just, my whole life was just wrapped around that stuff, you know, and I never changed. I mean, I go to flea markets and I buy weird things that I can inlay into guitars. And, you know, I was talking to the guy from SNL today, Saturday Night Live, and he goes, hey, you know how you put that V8 emblem on my guitar you built for me? And I go, yeah. And he goes, I'm kind of looking for something kind of like a lion, something maybe kind of that looks like a lion, like an emblem of a lion or something you put on there. So they'll give me ideas like that. And I'm like always looking for just weird things. You know, sometimes I'll buy them on eBay. Sometimes I'll find them at a garage sale. Sometimes they're at a flea market. You know, it's just fun. I enjoy it. And I've got boxes full of stuff at my house, my old shop. I worked in my basement for 8 years. So I left my basement because my wife's like, oh my gosh, you're getting so busy. You've got to get out of here. And we drove down the road one day, you know, the clouds parted and the rays shot down. It's like, there's a building, you know? So we stopped and I called the guy, Gary Tom, great guy. And he goes, well, what do you do for a living? And I said, well, I build guitars. He said, what makes you think you can actually make a go of it here in this little building that nothing has ever worked in this building? He goes, not to diss any of the other businesses that I've rented to, but nothing's really ever worked. Why do you think it's going to work for you? And I said, because I've already got a huge customer base. You know, I build custom guitars and I do restoration and repairs, and that's what I do, you know, and I've got some big accounts with some of the major corporations, and the biggest in the world is Guitar Center. I've worked for those guys for 10 years. So they'll send over all their high-end stuff, and I'll do that kind of stuff on the side. So it's not just custom-built stuff. It's restoration. You know, Grandpa's guitar was found in the attic. Can you do anything with this? Well, yeah, I can bring that back. This is a 62
guitar.
It's a Fender guitar, all right? I took all the finish off of it. I refinished it in nitrocellulose lacquer, which is the original lacquer they used in the 50s and early 60s on Fender guitars.
How is it different working with the folks in Nashville as opposed to New York?
Nashville guys all like big fat necks on their guitars. They like chunky necks, necks that are the size of your forearm. That's just what they like. In New York, they don't. They like thinner necks. In the Midwest, they like thinner necks. And the reason I would say people prefer that in Nashville as opposed to New York or California even, Nashville, for one thing, is just, it's an anomaly. Nashville is a very unique part of the universe because people there play 24/7. They do not stop. They know their tone. Why? Because they play 24/7. There's a lot of tone that comes out of a neck of a guitar. And most people, if you don't build, you don't know that, you know? So
what do you mean when they play 24/7? You mean they're performing a lot?
They don't stop. They play all the time. They never stop playing. They get up and they play, they go to bed and they're playing. And I know a lot of guys down there that are in their 50s that are just amazing. And tell me these guys haven't put in their, you know, 186,000 hours playing guitar. So they must know what they're talking about. And, you know, based on their information, I try to take what they've told me and offer it to other customers, like in the New York area or LA area. My guys in Nashville love the big necks. Well, I can't play those big necks, but there's a lot of tone that comes out of those fatter necks. And it was something that they did in the early 50s, that Fender did in the early 50s. The necks were huge, you know, and it's just tech stuff. The guitar players and guitar luthiers would know what I'm talking about.
I don't know what you're talking about, but I love hearing you say it. Is there a way we can hear one of these instruments, Glenn?
Let me plug something in. Let me play a guitar I built, and I'll give you a little bit of a...
Yeah, cool.
Let me do this, and then we'll do that. There's so many different sounds that they would get out of these things for different reasons. I think some of the earliest guys that were playing the Fenders, especially the Stratocasters, were like guys that I like were like Bob Wells, you know, doing House of Blue Lights.
Country or Texas Swing.
Yeah, Texas Swing. Yeah, I love that. And who would have thought? And then, of course, Buddy Holly, you know, he started playing rock on. It's like, wow, there's a country guitar that now they're playing rock and roll on. And, you know, it was just such a, I don't know, it was such a period throughout the course of American music that was transitional based on really just a few different guitars.
Kevin Hefferman, vintage guitar dealer in Noblesville, owner of Center Stage Vintage Guitars, which is also their website.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
You know, we're partial here at Indiana Weekend to interesting people with good stories to tell. And we love a good local diner where people like that can often be found. So we had a great visit with former Marion newspaper editor Ed Breen at the 9th Street Cafe in Marion.
Talk about where we are and the significance of this place to Marion.
We are at Paula's 9th Street Cafe, which is a one large room restaurant on the west side of Marion. It's been here forever since the rocks were small pebbles. It's just one of those places where folks come for breakfast and lunch. Not open for dinner. 2 o'clock, everybody's out of here. But it's just a marvelous place to kind of keep track of the pulse of the community.
You come here on a regular basis, right?
Yes, there is a gathering of old codgers that gathers here every Friday morning for breakfast, and I'm in and out of here several times a week in one way or another. Yeah.
Tell me about that Friday morning gathering.
Friday morning gathering is retired electrical contractor, retired insurance executive, retired hospital administrator, a retired plumber, and an old beat-up news guy. And we usually get most of the world's problems solved prior to about 10:30 or quarter of 11.
What's the feeling of those folks? You've just named several retired people, so...
Right. I think that some of it's generational. You know, our parents didn't understand us when we were young. We don't understand our kids or the generation that's coming up after them. We think that their music is terrible, their political ideas are worse, and that the country is just going to fall apart unless we're there to support it. So there is that mindset going into it. But I think there's a lot of frustration right now with my generation, in my generation, and probably the next generation down, in that nothing seems to be working right. Whether it's getting the potholes filled down the street, or whether it's getting the national unemployment figures where they should be, nothing's working right.
And people haven't always felt that way. I mean, you've been tapping public opinion for decades.
Oh, yeah. I think everything changed, again, for my generation, everything changed with two events. One was Vietnam, and the other was Watergate. And when you take the influence of those two events on the lives of people, say, between the ages of 60 and 80, it changed everything, because we came away with the feeling that we could no longer trust our government. And that moved down to the local level in recent years, too.
This place is kind of a crossroads. If you wanted to find out what's on the minds of people in Marion, this would be a good place to start.
If I were running someone's political campaign, I would be here 3 times a day to take the pulse of the community, because I think this is where you would find out what people's desires are, what their frustrations are, and what it is that they think they can do next.
What's the biggest change in public opinion or public attitudes that you've seen? And one thing that comes to mind for me is the attitude towards same-sex marriage seems to have changed a lot in Indiana.
Isn't that an interesting story? That in Indiana we have gone from whatever it was, 77-80%, something like that, opposition to same-sex marriage, to the point where it's now about 50-50, and and the folks in the state legislature are scared to death to go one way or the other on it because they're going to lose half of their constituents. That is a truly interesting social phenomenon, the way that we as a society have embraced that concept.
Indiana went for a Democrat for president in 2008 for the first time and since 1964, LBJ, but didn't support him 4 years later. Where's Grant County been in all that?
Well, they're very, very sorry that they strayed from the true facts in 08, by and large. It's going to be another 40 years before that happens again. It's just not the nature of the Indiana culture. Hi, Bob.
Hey.
How are you?
Oh, just fine. Good show today.
Somebody has just walked by.
This is Bob Felbert. Bob is a retired teacher, Vietnam veteran, has an earned doctorate, and we're not sure how he ever got that, but you did, right?
Who you pay.
Okay. We're just sitting here talking about what has changed. And here's Cheryl. Come on over here. Cheryl was a school librarian for a good many years. This is John Strauss.
Oh, okay. Hi.
Nice to meet you. What's on people's minds?
What's on people's minds? The economy is always on their mind, and they have very doubtful ideas about what Congress is doing and what Congress isn't doing. It's seeing that it's deadlocked, ineffective.
In you graduated from high school in
65. Ball State in 69, Vietnam in 72, and then I got the master's in 74 and the doctorate in 87.
But when you were a kid, by and large, there was a belief that government at every level was going to do the right thing to accomplish whatever it was that we needed, whether it was the potholes filled in the street,
right,
or fixing income tax.
Right. The problem was always bigger than the politics, and that the problem came first, then the politics. Now it's the other way around.
Bob Felbert and his wife Cheryl walked by as we were talking with former Marion newspaper editor Ed Breen at the 9th Street Cafe in Marion. We stopped there because Marion, where we're heard on FM 90.9, is pretty typical of the former Indiana manufacturing towns faced with the need to remake themselves. We wanted to tap into the public sentiment there, and we're lucky to know Ed Breen, the former local editor who's still mixing things up in his early 70s. Now as a thoughtful, sometimes provocative morning host on WBAT Radio. And that, my friends, is our Year in Review show for 2014. I'm John Strauss. Thanks for all your support during the year, and big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft. Glad you could join us this time. Hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a thought or suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture of Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from FlexSteel, Bassett, and Simmons Beauty Rest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.